Welcome to the Pro Basketball Talk podcast. I'm Dan Feldman. Very glad to be joined today by Michael Pina of Sports Illustrated. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, Dan. How are you?
Great. So you, a couple weeks ago, already went over your all-NBA teams. You were so far ahead of the curve. And this is one of the reasons I want to have you on. The number one reason is you know basketball. You're sharp. This is going to be good analysis from you. That's number one. But number two, I re-listened to your podcast from a couple weeks ago about all-NBA. And it was like a time capsule. It was like, all right, here's this moment in time. You kind of think the regular season was wrapping up. You can make your picks. And maybe your picks are going to hold. Maybe they're not. But I feel like the discourse around All-NBA has taken off since. I think that podcast that Zach Lowe and Kevin Arnovitz did together in ESPN really, really kicked into overdrive. You know, listening to your podcast, like, oh, should Jokic and Embiid, could they all both make All-NBA first? You know, such a brief aside of like, no, of course not. And now that is the discussion. I think that's where we have to start. Give a little more time to that. But let's start right before that with, what is your criteria for All-NBA? What are you looking for? And then we can get into Jokic and Embiid. Can they both make the first team?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful question. And honestly, I try to be as consistent as I can with it, but it drifts from case to case, I think, honestly. I mean, I'm obviously very into analytics. I go what the numbers say. I think I try to, more so than when I'm writing a column or researching anything, I look at the total, like just counting stats more for all NBA, just to try to measure just a player's impact on the entire 82 game season. But then, you know, you obviously get into all the advanced numbers, all the catch-all metrics, on-off, just general impact. I try not to care that much about winning. I do care. It matters for sure. That's the point of the sport and why they play the games. But I don't really use it as a splitting hairs differentiator if I'm going between two really close cases. And we'll get into a lot of that as we talk, I'm sure. But winning isn't really that important to me. I can't really explain why. I just try to pick the best players at every position, and try my best to parse out the, you know, parse context as much as I can with who was available, what weaknesses their team has that they try to make up for. And so, you know, it's fun to talk about this generally, but I think I'll make more sense when we get into specifics.
Yeah, I think I have a similar outlook. It's this season only. It's not a prediction. It's not predicting what you're going to do in the playoffs. It's not based on what you've done prior in your career. It's how much did you contribute to winning this season? I'm with you. It's not about team winning. Team winning can help you determine how much an individual contributes, mm-hmm. but it's an individual award. And so if you have somebody who's doing his best to prop up a bad team and doing a great job of that, he's going to get a lot of credit. If you have somebody who's just a cog on a great team, he's not going to get as much credit from me. But you can plug it in, right? You can say, wow, the Suns are really great. Why are they so great? I think part of it we'll get into is they've got several very good players.
Yes.
But I think you can look, well, wow, they're this good. Maybe those top guys deserve more credit than I would have thought if I didn't think they'd be as good. I was very high on Phoenix, so I'm not surprised by this. But I think you look backward from team success to try to get to that individual marker. Mm-hmm. Now there's the positional dilemma, right? So you can say these players are this good, and that's a hard enough discussion. Now we got to plug them into positions or not plug them into positions, I guess, if you want. I don't think – I'm not putting Jokic and Embiid on my – first team. You have a vote, an actual vote. I do not. Some people are going to listen more to what you're saying. You're also, you know, more on top of this than me, of course. So, you know, listen to Michael.
I don't know about that, Dan.
I'm setting this up here on something where I think we're going to agree. So maybe I'll look good by mm-hmm. by proxy. Mm-hmm. Jokic is a center, Embiid is a center. Neither one is a power forward. Except I got one little twist on this after we have the forward center discussion. What is your comfort level on putting both of them on first team, assuming, you know, you have them both in the top three, if not top two of your MVP ballot, like most people, as mm-hmm. would I?
Yeah, I definitely have them both in the top three, I'll say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, these guys are centers. It's very simple. The center position is designated as something where we're supposed to pick a first team center, a second team center, and a third team center. And unless until we go positionless with this exercise, I'm going to have Joel Embiid as either the first team or the second team or the third team, and I'll have Nikola Jokic the same deal. And then I'll pick another center, and he'll go on the remaining team, third team. So it's really, it's bizarre almost to me that there's this push in kind of like a, it's kind of an awkward way to just kind of stuff the best players onto first team when it's just like not how it should be. If we want to go positionless again, then let's do it. And I'll happily have both of them on first team because they're both two of the five best players of this season, no doubt about it. But that's not how it is. So I don't really feel comfortable putting one of them as a forward when they aren't forwards. It just doesn't make sense to me.
So tell me if I'm crazy. When I look at a position, right, it's hard. We have these antiquated positions of guard, guard, forward, forward, and center, which is mm-hmm. not really how the league exists anymore. It no. was how it existed when they created this. And, you know, part of me says, well, maybe it should just be point guard, two wings, and like a forward and then a center, I guess kind of reflects how things are now. You know, but that's tough. And then part of me says, well, look at, and James Harden, I think, is the quintessential example of this. Teams put their best player who could be a point guard or a shooting guard, they put him at point guard. Like, talent is stacked at point guard for a reason. So if you only, even though teams only have one point guard, if you put only one point guard on all NBA, you know, you're giving too much benefit to the wings, who I think generally across the league are not as good because teams want to put the ball in the hands of their best player. If you have a James Harden who could be either, you want him to be your point guard. As the league's evolved, there's a reason, you know, Harden is just really considered a point guard now for the most part when he was clearly a shooting guard when he was younger. That was more about an evolution of the league than his own game. And so we're already doing this tricky thing where we're getting two point guards on. You know, when we go through the guards, you know, I'm going to be disproportionately, the guys we're talking about, the guys I'm putting on, they're going to be disproportionately point guards over shooting guards. Those are different positions, but because of how this works. Anyway, on Jokic and Embiid, could I consider Jokic a point guard? Now, I look at two things. I look at defense. Defensively, he's clearly a center, right? Mm-hmm. To a degree, you are what you defend. But point guard is sort of the exception where I'm looking at, well, what is your role on the offense? Because that is such a unique position offensively. You are the hub offensively. You're the guy bringing up the court, the ball of court offensively. You're the guy, you know, the center of the attack, making the plays offensively. That's so much of what Jokic is. I don't think I'm comfortable putting him at point guard, but I find that far more reasonable than putting him at power forward.
Yeah. I mean, what is a center, right? Like what, watch how Jaren Jackson Jr. functions in Memphis's offense when he's the nominal center and Steven Adams is on the bench. This guy's like coming off screens. I just don't understand how we define that position now as opposed to, I don't even know, 10, 15 years ago. Like Rudy Gobert is this one guy who is, I guess, the closest thing, but he doesn't really post up. I mean, I guess offensively, Joel Embiid for sure, but I'm with you. Like Nikola Jokic will bring the ball up. They'll run inverted pick and rolls where he is the ball.
Are they
handler.
Inverted?
Well, that's a great question.
I guess they're inverted by size, right? Size is a big indicator of what position you play.
100%. And I mean, if you watch them play, Monte Morris sets like a million wedge screens for Jokic to free him up, as opposed to the other way around off ball. And he's so unusual that it is, he's truly positionless. So it's like, he's a great case for why we should not have center and forward and guard on this anymore. But like, I was looking at LeBron James, who we'll, I'm sure, talk about in this discussion, and he is listed as a guard this season. And it's kind of like,
well, he could be either, right? Like you're thinking addition to forward.
Yes, yes, he is. He okay. is also a forward. But it's like, okay.
Or is he a center?
Is he? Yeah, but it's also like I look at his team and I'm like, well, he plays with Russell Westbrook. So Russell Westbrook is a guard. And then offensively, we've been calling all season for Russell Westbrook to basically fill the positional duties of a center. So it's like, I don't know how to do it. I really don't. So
well, that's why I think size is probably the simplest and most important and under discussed yes. thing, right? Like if you're the shortest player, you're a point guard. If you're the yes. tallest, you're a center, right? I mean, that's not exact, but that's a strong indicator.
No, you watch the Brooklyn Nets. Bruce Brown plays center on offense in a lot of lineups.
He is. He thank goodness he's not in contention for All-NBA because he might be the toughest in the whole league to pin down.
Yeah, exactly. So I just think it's a really it's a simple solve. Just have us pick the 15 best players. That's how it should be. That would also create, I think, more. More beneficial conversation and more fascinating discussions about all of this, as opposed to us arguing.
Are you telling me our positional discussion is not fascinating?
It is. It's look, it's just like we don't need to be doing this. Like we all know that this is that the NBA is gravitating towards positionless basketball. It's been doing it for at least the past 5, 6, 7 years, and like. Come on. Like, it would just be so much cooler if we could just say, okay, these are the 5 best players. And then whoever that 6th guy was, that would be a fun debate, 5 versus 6. Because I think it's not clear as to, and I think a lot of people would have different different lists for 15, for 10, for 5. And that would just be more, I don't know, that'd be more fun.
I want to make a couple points on positions before we move on because I can't take a hand. Boring as you say this is, I think it was Zach Lowe who brought up a point, and I'm glad you brought up LeBron. You look at his team. I think Zach Lowe's point was, well, you look at Jokic, and he handles the ball some, and he shoots from the outside, and he's tall, and, you know, you describe that, and it sounds like a lot of times you're describing a power forward, so it's okay to consider him a forward, but you got to look relative to somebody's teammates, right? You look on Denver's team. Because he's taller than him, but like, there's no center he's playing with. If he were Jaren Jackson Jr. playing with Steven Adams, you know, say Jokic is the power forward, fine. But that player isn't in Denver playing with Jokic. And then as far as the discussion, I think one fear potentially from the NBA is, you know, if you make all NBA positionless, now first team all NBA is the same as your MVP ballot, I think. I pick these the same way. I have the exact same criteria. I don't know of anybody necessarily having it different enough or different at all. And so you're eliminating a little bit of a discussion, right? The NBA wants people talking about the NBA. So that could be one drawback.
Can I butt in for 2 seconds?
Yeah.
So when I put together my MVP, for years, my fake MVP, this is my first year with a real MVP ballot. I really stick to the word value when I am trying to pick who is the MVP. And so I heavily look at like on-off metrics. That's not the only criteria for me for MVP, of course. But I love to see like how a team performs when a player is off the floor or is injured. And, you know, there's a lot of different factors that go into that for sure. And sometimes a player can't help that his bench is really good, et cetera. But that's just kind of how I view it. So my MVP ballot will not be who I think are the 5 best players in the league, if that makes any sense.
So the way I look at it is I do like looking at the on-off, but I'm trying to see how much a player contributes. It's not how good the player is, right? Like, we could have a debate of who the best player in the NBA is, but I think that's different than what you produce this season. And I'm not sure if that's what you're differentiating. But for me, the on-off, I don't want to punish a player because his backup is really good or give him extra credit because his backup is really bad. For me, I'm looking at the on-off and you have to look deeper because of specific positional things. But I'm trying to get a sense of how good are his teammates. I want to know, my basic question is how good was this guy's team on the floor? And how much is he responsible for that? So to get a sense of that, I got to figure out how good his teammates are. And that's where the on-off can give you a clue. But I think sometimes if you're just looking at it in the value sense, that's what I want to avoid, is punishing somebody for having a good backup or giving them too much credit for having a bad backup. That's not what I'm interested in.
That's fair. That's very fair.
Do you do all NBA different from that? Are you not quite as hung up on value as you see it there?
I'm not necessarily. Like, there's some players that we'll discuss where, like, if you're just having this, if you're just like a player who I want to remember, like, in 10 years, when I look back at the 2021-22 season, who really will stick out to me as being a critical figure? For whatever reason, well, a positive reason.
Well, there you go. I'm glad you added that. It drives me nuts when people say, like, well, shoot, we're having all these debates about, like, Ennis Freedom and China. Like, he's not making an All-NBA because of that.
No. And Kyrie Irving, he is not on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Kyrie Irving is the story of the season. Yeah.
Yeah. There are a few other names that I would say that I in a positive sense for their play, I will remember them for this season. And I think that should be captured and rewarded on All NBA to a certain extent, more so than maybe in just like a simple MVP ballot.
Interesting. All right. I think we've had enough lead up. Let's settle the first debate. Do you have Jokic or Embiid on your first team?
I have Nikola Jokic on my first team as my first team center. Go ahead.
So I think it's very agreeable that Embiid is significantly better defensively, so that means you think Jokic is that far ahead offensively.
Okay, so I just think, like, in general, Nikola Jokic is a better basketball player. I think that he is not a liability on the defensive end. And, you know, there's obviously a ton of numbers. I'm not just relying on numbers when I say this, but a lot of numbers love Nikola Jokic's defense this season. And Denver's defensive rating when Nikola Jokic is on the floor is only slightly worse. Like, I think it's a point right now per 100 possessions worse than Joel Embiid's defensive rating when he's on the floor for the Philadelphia 76ers. But, like, I don't think that the gap between them defensively is that major. And I kind of do think that offensively, the way Jokic plays, the way he elevates his teammates, is just substantially more impactful positively than what Joel Embiid does. And I don't want to just, like, parse, I guess, like, just like the way they approach the game. And there's, you know, we could get into numbers, every number, every efficiency number metric favors Nikola Jokic and has all season. I watch Joel Embiid play, and I think Joel Embiid is obviously tremendous. He's one of the five best players in the world right now, I would say. But the way he reacts to double teams and triple teams is just sometimes just not what you want, to be honest with you. And, like, the way Nikola Jokic responds to a ton of defensive attention, where he's just picking you apart with one of the smartest brains we've ever seen. I really appreciate that aesthetic a little bit more than how Joel Embiid will, you know, see the double coming and want to get a dribble and then a shot over the top of it as quickly as he can. And I don't know, that kind of rubs me the wrong way, to be honest. And I think that offensively, when you just look at how, and I guess this is, again, just my personal preference, but, like, the reliance that Joel Embiid has on the free throw line. And when you watch him play, it's just like, I don't know. There's some fouls where I'm just like, how is that? What is even happening here? And not to get too Ty Lue here, who said this, recently said that Joel Embiid would not be super efficient or whatever, a top 10 scorer or whatever it was without the free throw line.
Yeah.
He's never been particularly efficient without it. And you can't say the same thing about Nikola Jokic. So, yeah, there's, like, a lot of reasons. This could be a whole podcast why I like Nikola Jokic more than Embiid here. But I just think Jokic is the best player, I think, in the world right now. And,
wow.
And what he's done with the cast that he's had, the supporting cast that he's had this season is just absolutely, I mean, there's still a path for this team to finish with home court in the Western Conference. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's possible. That's insane. It's wild. And if you gave Nikola Jokic Seth Curry this season for however many games Embiid had him, I mean, come on. That's like going to – like I could go on and on. But Nikola Jokic is a marvel. Love watching him play. And for me, like the playmaking and the way that he just will pick apart any defensive coverage, the way he moves without the ball, the way he's efficient on from the post, his touch around the basket – we talked about the inverted pick and roll stuff. He could screen and dive. He's everything. So Nikola Jokic is my first team center.
So I agree with your conclusion. For me, I'm very much, I probably enjoy watching Jokic play more too, but I'm very much conscious of trying not to account for that. I don't care about aesthetics. I care about effectiveness. Mm-hmm. And so I probably have it a little closer than you do. I think Embiid's foul drawing is a big positive. He's drawing him, right? You can say maybe he shouldn't, whatever. He does, right? I'm looking at the conclusions. He's making his free throws. Sure. And it's a part now on the podcast a couple weeks ago. He really opened my eyes to something that's an underrated thing. Joel Embiid can go in the game, draw these fouls, and get the other team or get the Philadelphia into the bonus.
Yep.
And then when he's sitting on the bench, the 76ers offense is benefiting from that. That's, you know, show me any advances. I just don't think even – I don't think any of the numbers we have publicly are really accounting for that, but that's a nice little helpful thing that bridges the gap. Because like you said, basically any publicly available advance that you can look at favors Jokic by a good margin. And I still have him ahead. I don't think the gap defensively is as narrow as you do. I think Embiid is somebody who I haven't gone all the way through, but might end up on my mythical defensive player of the year ballot. Jokic is not, but Jokic holds up fine defensively. He's not a liability like he used to be. He's solid, and if you're that good offensively, and this is where I totally agree with you, you know, the ability to keep the ball moving, he's making quick, correct decisions, can deliver passes anywhere, shoots from anywhere. That is so valuable. And I think on an individual level, offense trumps defense because you can put the ball in Jokic's hand every possession. Defensively, you can play away from Embiid. So I think it's more of an offensive word. So I am with you on Jokic over Embiid. Is there anybody else you had as a clear first team lock?
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary.
Oh, great question. Clear first team lock. At forward, Giannis Antetokounmpo is a clear first team lock.
Agree. That might have been I think that was the easiest call. I'm guessing you like everybody else, kind of at this point, a three-man MVP race with Jokic, Embiid, and Giannis. Uh-huh. And while Giannis is the only forward, that one is easy.
Right. And we are recording this one day after the Bucks played the Sixers and beat them, and Giannis blocked Embiid shot. And I don't want to – it's one play.
It was easy before.
Yeah, it was. I mean, yeah, Giannis is, I feel like if he hadn't won two MVPs already, the case mm-hmm. for Giannis and the outcry and the volume for him to win MVP this season would be so much louder. He's been ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Yeah. So, I think I have him ahead right now. It's very close.
Of Embiid?
Of Jokic.
You have Giannis first for MVP.
It's close. I could go either way. I didn't look closely at it for this. I just compared Jokic to Embiid. Because mm-hmm. and then, like we said, Giannis is a clear first team at forward. I could go either. I mean, again,
I didn't mean to disparage that opinion, which is totally valid.
I haven't looked into it very closely enough. That's where I'm gut leaning at this moment, but it could be okay. I mean, it's very close to me.
Yeah, I'm probably going to have Giannis second on my ballot for MVP. It's so funny when you look at his evolution, and I know we're not supposed to account for previous seasons, and I'm not really doing that. But I just want to make the point that the way that he has, in this season without Brook Lopez, and I know that Milwaukee's defense has kind of slipped a little bit overall. But the way that he's kind of filled that role sometimes, I know obviously Bobby Portis is the nominal center in a lot of those lineups, but Giannis has been playing a lot of five and has embraced, and he did this in the playoffs last year, of course, but it really embraced screening and diving a lot more this season with Chris Middleton and Jrue Holiday. And if you look at Jrue Holiday, especially his shooting numbers off the bounce have been tremendous this season. And I credit Giannis just drawing so much attention with those picks, with those dives as well. And obviously he can just grab the ball, go coast to coast and dunk it in 5 seconds as he did at the end of the first half in last night's game, which is one of the most ridiculous plays I've seen all season. Giannis is a lock for me, first team forward.
Was there anybody else for a first team spot that was an easy call for you?
So you mentioned at the top the All-NBA episode of Open Floor that I recorded with Rohan Notgurney a few weeks ago, and we definitely hit that too soon.
Well, you know, you're ahead of the curve.
That's what I was trying to be. I was trying to do that. But I did not anticipate this much stuff happening down the stretch. So for that listing, I had LeBron James as a first team forward. And I felt pretty confident about that. And I don't think anyone is wrong who has LeBron first team or will at the end of this season. He's been incredible. Like, even for a 37-year-old, for a 25-year-old, doesn't matter. He's been amazing, especially when you account for the players who've been around him and how difficult it is to be efficient, particularly inside the arc, as he has been. But Jason Tatum's last few weeks, and when you kind of, I said at the top, like, I really value total statistics for all NBA, and he's just played so many minutes and his on-off is so wild. Like, it's up there with Jokic at this point in the season, in just net rating. And yeah, so I don't really have any other locks for you. The guards, there's a lot of great candidates, and I have two that I like for first team, but if you check back with me this time next week, maybe I won't have these two in this slot. But for right now, for forward, my other forward is Tatum, and I feel pretty confident about that.
So the one other lock I have, and we'll get back to Tatum, is Stephen Curry. I initially had him closer to the rest of the pack, but the more I looked into it, I think people are undervaluing him because they're comparing him to what he did in prior seasons.
Yes, they are.
And they're comparing him to somebody who looked like an MVP front runner earlier in this season, and he fell off. I still think he's having the best season by a guard, by a good enough margin where I pretty comfortably have him on the first team. Not quite the Giannis level automatic, but up there. What he provides, you know, as efficient scorer still, even in a down year for him, such efficient scoring. He's doing more as a passer than he has in the past. because Draymond has been out. Draymond is often their sort of de facto point guard. He's just having an excellent year. And the spacing, right? It's not just the efficient scoring, but it's when you shoot like that, it's the spacing, it's the attention you attract. You know, how many times does he get trapped and give the ball up and the Warriors create something efficiently, you know, 4-on-3 because of him, right? And that might not show up on the stat sheet depending on how many passes there are. It could help his plus minus or the team's offensive rating with him on the court. And that's sort of where you see the impact of how good this guy has been. So I had him pretty comfortably on. I know you had him on initially. I'm guessing you still have him on your first team.
I do still have him on my first team. And the only reason why he isn't a lock is this injury that he has. And I want to see the last however many games there are in the season, where they're like six, seven games for most teams right now.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple players who – a couple guards who are having tremendous seasons, and if they blow the doors off the hinges over this past week or so, they could unseat him. But you make one of the great points for Curry is his true shooting isn't what it was. His 3-point shooting isn't what it was, even though he's taking 12 a game, and a lot of them are so hard. Is just the attention that he draws and how much better how easy he makes life for his teammates. Like, Andrew Wiggins being an all-star starter this season is like one of the most wild things we'll ever see. And I'm like, that's because of Steph Curry, people. Like, that's just, he's amazing in just the way he plays, the energy that he has. His conditioning is second to none. As a screen setter, the chaos that he creates, I think that is, like, when you look at how good Golden State's offense is, regardless of who else is on the floor, like, there was a whole thing when Draymond initially went out and they started to slide as a team. Their offense, when Steph Curry is on the floor without Draymond Green, Golden State's offense is better than when Steph and Draymond play together, which is one of the more wild stats this season, and kind of bucks a narrative that I don't think is fair to Steph and his value. And he's just the whole – I think Draymond's really valuable, of course, for everything that he does offensively and defensively. But the Golden State Warriors are Steph Curry to me. And they were second. They had the second best record in the league for most of the season. And when you watch them play, short of Jordan Poole just going bananas and like banking in a bunch of threes, when you watch them play without Steph Curry, it's not the same basketball team. So Steph's still on my first team right now.
So I've got six guards that I think are clearly above the rest. It's just a matter of slotting them. You mentioned Steph Curry's true shooting percentage being down, and it is for him. He is the only one of the six above 60%. He's still leading this group, which is why I get back to you. You got to compare him to the other players this season, not past versions of Steph Curry. My other first team guard, we can talk more about some of these guards. I have Chris Paul. And then I could go any direction on Chris Paul, Ja Morant, Devin Booker and Trae Young, which one of them is going to make the first team and one of them is going to be on the third team. So it's a decent swing in terms of reputation. And the fact that I can't really separate Chris Paul and Devin Booker, Phoenix teammates, is tough on me. Devin Booker is the better scorer. Chris Paul is the better playmaker, the better defender. In aggregate, who's better? I'm not sure. When one plays without the other, it's pretty similar. The Suns are very good either way. They're two excellent players. I just think Chris Paul, even with the time he's missed, you know, he's back. He's going to get his minutes back up there. And so I'm a big believer availability is a big part of this. And even with him missing a little bit more time than the rest of these guys, it won't be more than Ja. And it's, you know, not at this point, you know, Chris Paul's played 60 games. Donovan Mitchell's at 63, who I haven't mentioned yet. Devin Booker's at 64. Morant's at 56. Trae Young is at 69. You know, I just think Chris Paul, his control of the game, he's going to probably get you a big lead. And if he doesn't, he is just going to crush you in crunch time. He is so much in control in those tight moments that one way or another, like, there's a reason his teams win. There's a reason the Suns are so good. And a lot of it is Devin Booker. I think slightly more of it is Chris Paul.
So Chris Paul, man, I did not have him on any of my teams.
Still.
Man, this is so tough. I want to make clear that I totally understand Chris Paul's value. I totally understand what makes him special. I totally understand just his expertise in surgically operating on defenses in crunch time. Like, I get everything, I swear. And I just look at all the other guards, and you mentioned basically all of them. And I'm just like, these guards are just by a hair having more impressive seasons to me. And I we could in 7 days, if Chris Paul continues to play really well down the stretch, in totally meaningless games for the Phoenix Suns, then maybe he'll slide on. But like, for me right now, he's not on any of my teams, and I feel gross about it. I'm not going to lie.
Well, so one thing I did was I moved Luka to forward.
Okay.
Would that be something the way the NBA does it, you have the ballot, you see it, is they say players can be eligible at certain positions. I'm a believer that doesn't mean you should be able to put them at a position, like we talked about with Embiid and Jokic. Mm-hmm. But I think it'd be devastating if there's a player you legitimately thought, if you viewed it the same way you and I do, where you actually have to play this position, and there's a player you legitimately thought belonged in a position and you couldn't put him there, that would stink. So I'd rather the NBA give voters flexibility. I don't want voters taking advantage of it. Do you think Luka Doncic at forward is taking advantage of it? Because I feel like, look, he plays without Jalen Brunson. I think the best description for Luka Doncic is the point guard. But he plays a lot with Jalen Brunson and Spencer Dinwiddie, who are more guard-like. Luka's bigger, he's sturdier, he guards plenty of small forwards. And so I think it's enough where I'm comfortable putting him at forward.
He guards whoever can't dribble on the other team.
Probably tends to be a small forward more than a guard.
Yeah. Look, I'm okay with you putting him in as a forward. I think that how the balloting process works and the voting process works, he will not count as a forward unless he receives more votes as a forward.
Correct.
So I think more people will vote him as a guard, and I will vote him as a guard because it's like their offense revolves around his pick and rolls. That's what they are. And I know that Spencer and Brunson, especially of late, you know, they're playing these three guard lineups.
No, three guard lineups, right? We don't have to pretend they're not.
Yeah. So I think Luka is a guard, but because he's 6'8 and 200 whatever pounds, like, that's forward territory going into what you were talking about with size and how that matters with the center. I think that when I look at Luka, like, the fact that I have LeBron as a forward, and I thought that that was very obvious, even though LeBron will also initiate a ton of offense, I don't have a problem with it. But for whatever reason right now, I think of Luka more as a guard, and I'm voting him in as a guard.
Okay, so let's finish up this first team.
Okay.
Who was your other guard?
My other guard is Ja Morant. And
so far, or is that a prediction? Like, are you thinking you're going to end up with him at the end of the year? Or are you saying just based on what he's done so far? Because he's going to miss, you know,
so far. Okay. So far. And look, like, I'm going to be honest, I'm slightly biased towards Ja because I spent so much of this season, I've watched basically every Memphis Grizzlies game because I wrote a profile about him and I traveled to Memphis and I was just in the weeds with Ja Morant for basically the entire year. And so when I said this earlier, And this is who I was talking about. When I think about this season in 10 years, I will think about this as the season that Ja Morant ascended to become a superstar. And I mean, his, like, when he was, I know he's hurt now with this, with knee soreness, which is just a huge bummer. And I think it could be, you know, just in knowing what I know about him and how the team approaches him and everything, could be a little bit more serious than, like, I'm a little bit more worried about it. And I, you know, if it's keeping him out for these games, then yeah, but that's a different conversation. But he's just been, like, he's a huge reason. I know that they're 18-2 without him. I understand all that. The way he elevates this team to a completely different level when he's on the floor, and just like how masterful he is of the point guard position. The fact that he was literally doing things as a 6'3 guard in the paint that we've never seen before. Dwayne Wade never did it. Russell Westbrook never did it. Derrick Rose's MVP season pales in comparison to what Ja Morant has done this year. So I just think it was a really special season from him, and literally no one expected the Memphis Grizzlies to be second, have the second best winning, highest winning percentage in the league this year. I don't know where you had them heading in. I thought that they were going to be a play-in team. So, and I honestly, I understand that they're 18-2 again without him, but so much of that is because of Ja Morant. I don't think it's possible without him. And yeah, he's, you know, statistically a ridiculous basketball player, putting up ridiculous numbers, and could probably average more points and more assists if he cared to.
Yeah, I also had them as a play-in team. This is where I think we differ some, where I'm trying to separate some of those narrative things. Separate that Ja Morant is the most exciting player to watch in the NBA. I enjoy watching him probably more than anybody. I don't want to give him credit for that. I'm just looking for how effective he is, and he's pretty darn effective. One of the things I'm looking for is, it's not just what you do on the court that could be counted. I think leadership matters a lot. It's also incredibly hard to evaluate from afar. You know, the tone you set matters a lot. I can see with Ja Morant, that team feeds off him. He brings so much swagger. Like, he elevates that team in so many ways. They follow him. I think that all matters, as hard as it is to evaluate from afar. In this case, I think it's a little easier. It's so outward, and they're so open about taking the same attitude that he does. So I give him credit for that. That's why he was, like, my top pick right now for the second team, over maybe somebody like Trae Young, who I ended up on the third team, where very good player. We'll talk more about him, but, like, I'm not sure his team is feeding off him in the same way. And it might even be somewhat the opposite. Well, I think that should dock him. Again, as hard as that is evaluated from the outside, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Ja Morant isn't the tone setter appears. Maybe everybody loves Trae Young behind the scenes. But this is what I can see. This is what I can tell. And I'm also not looking forward to give extra credit for a surprise, right? Yeah, when we were wrong about the Grizzlies, we underrated the Grizzlies. I'm not giving bonus credit for that, just like I'm not giving bonus credit for LeBron being old or anything like that. It's what you've done this season. But I think we see Ja Morant similarly. I think our bigger disagreement is on Chris Paul, and even then I'm not convinced it's a huge disagreement. So who do you have as your other first-team forward? You know, you have Giannis at one slot, and then the other slot was originally LeBron. Who do you have now?
So I'm going Tatum.
Yep.
And yeah, like, I watch a lot of Boston Celtics games. I'm writing a story about Tatum's just evolutionary rise as a playmaker, which is one of the key reasons why I'm slotting him here after the start that he had that was very slow, very inefficient. Obviously the team struggled. But he's just been, I don't even know, like, he's just unstoppable, and has been for months. The Celtics are the best team in the NBA when he's on the floor. That's just how they look, how they carry themselves. And when he's not on the floor, they kind of fall apart a little bit, despite having the talent and the veteran poise that they have on that roster. He's so critical. He's been efficient for the past few months. Once his three-pointers started to fall, the sidestep threes, the step-back threes, just the simple pull-ups against drop coverage, he's taking those a lot more. than he was. He's bypassing the mid-range more and more and more, which those are shots that he's definitely able to hit, and he can get them off over strong contests, which makes him such a special offensive player. But he's learning that he doesn't need to take them and doesn't need to show off his bag. And just the way that he, like, the way he not only sees what defenses are doing and takes what is being given, but also is now manipulating them in those middle pick and rolls, in those empty corner pick and rolls. Like, he's just becoming that guy. And he's now, even though the Celtics reached the conference finals in 2020 with him as their best player, what he is now is kind of night and day in terms of this guy can be the best player on an NBA champion. I think that is not even a debate anymore. And I haven't even talked about his defense, which I think he will make all defensive teams in his career, plural. And he's absurd on that end in his versatility and his length and his competitiveness. So I don't really have a lot of bad things to say about Jason Tatum right now. I think he's been playing as one of the better players in the entire league for months. So he's my other choice here.
Yeah, he was my choice. I agree with everything you said. To add a couple of things, even with his slow start, for a slow start, that was pretty good, right? It was a slow start, and I'm a believer that you look at the whole body of work the whole season. But for the players who we look at who had a slow start, his was much better than all the rest of them. I think he is easily the best defender of anybody else we're considering it forward here. Again, that's with Giannis already on the team. I'm a little cautious of giving him too much credit for his defense. The Celtics obviously have been playing phenomenal defense altogether. Is it possible that Tatum is the weak link defensively, which I think says more about the Celtics than him? Again, I'm giving him credit for his defense, but the Celtics have three, four all defensive team candidates. Horford being big, I think, goes a long way defensively, being smart. Is it possible Tatum's the weak link on that starting lineup?
I mean, I'm not going to call him that. I think that
he's too good to call him that, right? It's all relative.
I just think they're all, I mean, this is why they're one of the best defenses we've seen in a very, very long time. They don't have any bad defensive players. Like, even, I don't want to go down a Celtics thing here, but they have, like, in their rotation, they have, everyone is an above average defender for their position, I would say.
Okay. So second team forward, I have LeBron and DeMar DeRozan, and a decent separation with the two of them, but I don't know, it's still close. That could still play out with the third team guys. LeBron, to me, has had basically three different seasons. He's had early in the year, like, if you watch him, he was doing so much to try to drag the Lakers to success. Like, he was doing everything all over the court, just trying to will this team to victory, and it was hard, and he was having mixed success at best. And then later in the year, I'm not sure exactly when the switch flipped. It seemed like he stopped caring quite as much. He wasn't hustling as much on defense, but he was still putting up his numbers. He was still finding his spots to coast until he could do something, especially scoring points that would show up in the box score. So I think a lot of statistical measures, he looked similar, but his impact on winning was not the same. Still, even when LeBron is coasting and like just looking to put up numbers, he's still helping his team, just not quite as much as he could, not quite as much as he was earlier in the year, not quite as much as where he'd be somebody where I have on the first team. And then the third phase of his season is injured, right? He's missed time. That counts against him to me, right? Availability is the most important ability. Mm-hmm. And then DeMar DeRozan is the other forward I have. Phenomenal year, probably a career year for him. It just seemed like bearing everything from the mid-range. I'm not sure how much he changed his game as much as he just got better. He developed the playmaking a few years ago. Has had a chance to do that in Chicago. Also, has not been good defensively. Was covered defensively, but made up for that kind of by hustling really hard as a small ball power forward. That unlocked a lot of things for the Bulls. I think in terms of evaluating a single season, how much value you provide toward winning, clutch play has an outsized importance. Again, this is not a prediction. I'm not predicting DeMar DeRozan will be clutch in the playoffs or next season or ever again. But he had all those clutch baskets that turned losses into wins. I think those matter. He's been very healthy. He's played a lot. So I have LeBron and DeRozan as my second team forwards. Who did you have?
So I have LeBron as one of my forwards. I think I agree with pretty much everything you said. And I just think that I think this is the second most accurate season of his entire career inside the arc, which is it's just like that's a wild thing to say about one of the best players who's ever lived, and remembering him just absolutely trounce defenses when he was on the Miami Heat, just doing what he wanted in the paint. Like that's wild to me that that's happening. So he's just had a tremendous season, and yeah, I echo basically everything you said. My other forward, so I understand why you went to DeRozan, and I think that's a wonderful pick, very deserving. His mid-range jumper has been one of the more unguardable individual weapons in the NBA this season. He's the reason why the Chicago Bulls are respectable for the first time in, I don't even, 5-6 years or whenever Jimmy Butler was traded.
Yeah.
This is a very special case for me because usually I do want to award players who've played as many minutes and as many games as DeMar has, but I'm going with Kevin Durant as my second team forward. He's only played 49 games. Obviously he missed a huge stretch because of the knee injury, but like this is, it's just, again, it's just like a special situation where it's like, this guy is freaking unstoppable and he's better than DeMar DeRozan. Like no one,
right.
You would say you would agree with that statement. I think, like, I know I said earlier that Nikola Jokic is the best player in the world. In the back of my head, every single time I say that out loud, I'm always like, yo, dude, like Kevin Durant's still alive and still playing basketball. So he's like, I mean, just there's no answer for this person. And I think honestly, like I was going through it earlier. I know he will not make an all defensive team, because the Nets are atrocious on defense, have been all season. And yeah, he has this reputation, I feel, as not being a good defender. Kevin Durant's a really good defender. Mm-hmm. And
I don't think he's like making an all defensive team.
No, but you know, it's interesting to me that he never has in his entire career. And I was like, I wanted to write a column to like get the narrative going in his favor, and then he got hurt, and that just kind of died down. But I feel like his
top four forward defensively is a high bar. Like he's a good defender, but top four forward.
It is. I feel like though I feel like he does strike he has the intimidation factor when he switches out on guys that. Mm-hmm. It's LeBron-esque, and he wipes shots away at the rim, and I think he's stronger than he looks in the post switching on bigs. So yeah, but anyway, like the case is not because of defense for Kevin Durant. The case is when he comes off a pick.
If you want to talk about differentiator with DeRozan, I think that's fairly significant.
That's fair, but. My case would just be like we'll see this in the playoffs if the Nets make the playoffs, but the most unstoppable action in basketball to me is Kevin Durant dribbles up the floor, gets a ball screen 35 feet from the rim, and then goes. That is the most unstoppable sequence any offense has in basketball. And that was the case when he was absolutely filleting the Milwaukee Bucks and Brooke Lopez in the playoffs last year. And that will be the case if the Brooklyn Nets make the playoffs. I think that Steve Nash will go to that play over and over and over again in the play-in. And I mean, there's no answer for Kevin Durant. He is he is an offense unto himself.
Yep, agreed. I just didn't think his playing time was quite there to have the impact. Right, him on the third team, right? It's such a credit to him to play as little as he did, just 49 games so far, and still comfortably make my third team. Mm-hmm. Who did you have at second team guard?
So the first lock I had for this was Luka, and Luka is one of the guys who I think could potentially slide onto first team for me. Over the lat, when I look at kind of the totality of the season, once it's over, he's, you know, obviously he started slow as well, and his team started slow, and it's as great as he's played. You need to factor in that he didn't come into the season in shape. Like, that just matters a lot. And
are you dinging him for that, or are you excusing that?
I'm dinging. Okay. I gotta ding that. Like, that's problematic. So especially when you don't play well by your standards. So there's that, but then it really speaks to how remarkable he has been over the past few months, where, you know, the three is falling. I mean, I don't need to explain Luka's game, but he's also just a completely unstoppable force and one of the smarter pick and roll operators in the league. Incredibly high usage. The responsibility that weighs on his shoulders is humongous. He's been a part of he plays humongous minutes on a team that has one of the better defenses in the league. One of the more surprising, I know you don't care about surprising and all that, and that's fine, but they've been one of the better defenses in the league.
I absolutely care about surprising. I'm so intrigued by surprising. I'm all about narrative. I love the narratives of the NBA, but I feel like it shouldn't matter. Like, for these awards, it should be genuine what's happening. And so you got to fight that, because I do love the narrative.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. So, but they've been one of the better defenses, and he's played humongous minutes, and I think he cares on defense, and he tries, and he uses his girth and his strength and his size to his benefit. He's a pretty good rebounder. So, yeah. So Luka had to go here for me, as a lock on second team guard. I could not imagine putting him lower than that.
So I have him as my third team forward. I'm glad you made the case for him, because I'm relatively down on him. Obviously, I still am very high on him having on my third team All-NBA. He has so much responsibility offensively, and so I give him some allowance for this, but he's just not quite as efficient as a scorer as these other players that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, at a certain point that just knocks you down. And some of this is he has to take the tough shots for this team. He's responsible for so much creation for himself, for others. He deserves that credit. Great points on his defense holding up in a good system. I just didn't quite have him, and I don't feel bad about having him on the third team. Some of this is a slow start, right? If it's just about how they're playing now, well, now I got to mark him up a couple notches. But that slow start does weigh him down, and you look at the season-long numbers, and, yeah, I have him on my third team at forward with Durant, who we already got into.
Is there such a thing as a traveler? Not a Delta, because we know on one flight, Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. While on the flight after, 8C is occupied by Jen, whose favorite snack is tea. That's why we provide fast, free Delta Sync Wi-Fi available for SkyMiles members, because at Delta, we know. Refill? Everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing. Free Wi-Fi available on most domestic flights. Terms of use apply.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So I believe I'm missing one second team guard from you to finish out your second team. I've got Luka at guard, and then Kevin Durant, LeBron James at forward, Embiid at center. Mm-hmm. And who is your other second team guard?
So this comes a day after his team blew a 20-plus point lead in embarrassing fashion against the Los Angeles Clippers. But I've just been enamored with Donovan Mitchell all season long. And I feel like if he played in almost any other market, like, sorry, to Utah, he would just be a bigger story. And, you know, I saw, like, the Phoenix Suns Instagram account posted this argument about how Devin Booker needs to be the MVP because he's averaging 25, 5, and 5, right? Which is just absolute nonsense. And then I was thinking, I was like, okay, so number one, that's nonsense because if you actually look at the MVPs who average 25, 5, and 5, what they actually averaged was like 28, 14, and 7. Like, right. That's so just like stop with that. But the other thing was like, wait a minute. So last year, the Utah Jazz were the best team. And Donovan Mitchell basically averaged 25, 5, and 5. He averaged, I think, 26, 5, and 4.3 or something like that.
He was definitely the leading scorer on the team with the best record.
Yeah. So it's just like, okay.
The Booker case.
Yeah. So it's just like, let's stop with this nonsense. But like, Donovan Mitchell has been even better. I feel like I'm a broken record talking about 2-point field goal percentage, but I just like, I care about it increasingly for some reason.
I mean, most guys take more twos than threes, but everybody's hung up on 3-point percentage.
And I just feel like that 3-point percentage is just so, it just fluctuates. And I know if a guy's a good shooter, or like for the most part, I know his pull up threes, which have been, kind of, you know, it's been a weapon for him for sure this season. But like the way he navigates in the paint, the way he hits, like he's just like the really tough floaters, like scoop shots, like he's just getting it done inside the arc in a way that he hasn't in the past. And it's part of the reason why his, like, if I'm trying, okay, so like the other guards that I have here, like, as you, like, Chris Paul is in contention here. Devin Booker is in contention here. And for me, like, it's unfair to those two, but like, and also I guess to Mike Conley, but like Donovan Mitchell doesn't have like the responsibility that Donovan Mitchell has to me is just different than those two. And the fact that Utah has had the best offense all season long because of him, largely because of him. And I know there's other factors there for why their offense is great, but he's kind of the engine. And I feel like he gets overlooked a little bit. And he's just been marvelous. And I know Utah is like, it's just like this morose, the storylines there are always negative. There's him beefing with Rudy. There's, if they don't reach the conference finals, everything's going to get blown up. Quinn Snyder is like already kind of pseudo has one foot out the door. And it's just like, okay, wait, but like Donovan Mitchell is incredible. And so I want to reward the season that he's had. And I think just by a hair, I think he's been a little bit better than some of the other guards who are in contention for the spot. So Donovan's my second team guard.
So I had the four players for first team, two second team spots, and third team. Really tight together is Chris Paul, Ja Morant, Devin Booker, and Trae Young. I had Mitchell like kind of a sixth guard on his own. I don't think he's quite on the level of those other players, but still having a very good year.
Man, you're part of the problem.
Yes, I absolutely am. I think he's got a good offensive environment. I think Quinn Snyder does a good job scheming that offense. There's good offensive talent around him. I'm digging Mitchell a little bit for some of the friction between him and Rudy Gobert that is weighing on the team. The expectation stuff, whatever. Maybe even give him a little extra credit for performing well amid this pressure. Although I'm not sure how much pressure there is on the Jazz in the regular season. But to me, I have Devin Booker on my second team. And to me, the close call is Devin Booker or Trae Young. But Devin Booker, I think the big differentiator is defense. Devin Booker has become a good defensive player. Mitchell has regressed, I think, pretty lousy on that. And that's part of what contributes to the friction with him and Rudy Gobert. Donovan Mitchell's defensive effort hasn't been there. You want to say they're similar offensively? I'd agree. I might even give the slight edge to Booker there. But I think defensively is what separates them.
Fair. I feel like Devin Booker is really fascinating. He's come along late in terms of his efficiency. And when Chris Paul was out, he was able to flash some of the playmaking that we've maybe some of us have forgot that he's able to make almost any pass that he has to. And I think that part of his game is unfairly doesn't get the attention that it deserves. But for me, it's like Donovan has to do that all the time, has to set up guys like the drive and kick offense that is why Utah is so successful. A lot of it, when you just watch them play, is like, is Donovan rejecting a screen, getting into the paint, drawing or collapsing the defense and then spraying it out, or hitting a floater, or muscling his way to an and one, or pulling up for three over a contest. And I know Devin Booker does a lot of those things as well. But it's just, I honestly like can't even put a finger on it. It's so imperceptible to me, like why I have Mitchell so slightly ahead of Booker. But I mean, Booker's tremendous as well. And I think earlier in the season, he was not that efficient. And he's come along of late and brought that up, and he's had some big time scoring performances, and his team is obviously tremendous. But
including with Chris Paul sideline, like I give him a lot of credit
for stepping up.
And, you know, that's not something Booker could do early in his career. There, you know, he was a very talented player, but he's part of the reason the Suns were so bad early in his career. He's at a different stage. It's not just them adding Chris Paul. He's great.
100%. 100%. Absolutely. So I don't, it sucks that when we have these conversations, it feels like we're kind of denigrating one player. I don't mean to do that at all. I think Devin Booker is fantastic. And it's clear to me that the NBA wants him to become one of the future faces of the entire league. That's that he's good enough, the talent is there for that to actually come true someday, potentially. But like, for me, it's just Donovan by like the slightest hair. But of course, if anyone has Devin Booker, I mean, there's really smart people out there who are going to have Devin Booker on their first team. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to argue with that. That's fine. Like, he's tremendous. He's unstoppable when he has it going. In that game the other, I think it was over the weekend against the Sixers, he had like 21 or something in the first quarter. I was just like, what is happening? So he's a walking heat check. He's incredible. But again, for me, it's Donovan. And if the Jazz completely fall apart over the next week and Devin Booker, you know, averages 30 and whatever, then Devin Booker could easily slide up ahead, and I will fall victim to recency bias. But for now, it's Donovan.
So the other player I had ahead of Donovan Mitchell is Trae Young. And I know the first time you did this, you had Trae Young on your third team. Is that still the case?
That is still the case, yes.
Okay, yeah. So I think we're probably higher on Trae Young. I think he's probably the most slept on candidate for this. And it's kind of silly to me why. Last year, the Hawks were ninth in offensive rating, and they were slightly better than the first place team when Trae Young was on the court. This year, the Hawks are third in offensive rating, and again, slightly better than the first place team with Trae Young on the floor. You know, we recognize Trae Young because of his offense. We know he's a bad defender, right? I just don't think that's so impactful from the guard position. I think you can cover for that. The Hawks' overall defense has just fallen in the tank. That's why the team has dropped off. And so, you know, I think Trae Young is even better than last year. I do think he deserves some of the blame for the team's defense falling off in two regards. One, he's not a good defender individually. That's the same.
He's very, very bad.
He's very bad. The other problem is when he's dominating the ball, I think there's something too. Guys don't feel involved. John Collins has talked about this some, like they don't feel connected. Like it's not a system conducive to getting maximum effort and intensity from the other players. And some of that falls on Trae Young, right? Like a lot of times I think his attitude somewhat correctly is, well, yeah, the best offense is me just dominating the ball. I'm this great shooter, scorer, passer. Like, let me set everything up. And there's truth to that. But not acknowledging how that makes the other players feel, how they respond to that, I think is a flaw in his candidacy, a flaw in his leadership. That's why I have him in the third team when some of his individual numbers are really good. The other thing, the Hawks have a winning record. They just happen to be 10th in this year's East. Like in an average Eastern Conference year, if they were up higher in the standings, I think Trae Young would be getting more credit for the exact same team results. It's just that the East is better. So you look at the Hawks all the way down to 10th and view that as a disappointment. But I had him very comfortably on an all NBA team.
I'm in a bunch of, you know, DM threads and group texts with a bunch of people who cover the NBA. And there is so much Trae Young slander that I'm always just like, I'm putting, when I'm thinking about putting everything together, like I want to like put Trae Young first in MVP and Trae Young on my first team All NBA just to push back against it, because I don't understand the degree to which people have a problem with him. He's first, you know, I talked about overall counting stats. There's a chance that and it's probably likely he will finish first in overall assists and first in overall points. With a team that when he's on the floor, Atlanta's offense is number one in the NBA. When he's off the floor, they are worse than the Houston Rockets and slightly better than the Detroit Pistons. So what you say about like his, I guess like when he first entered the league, obviously there's these Steph Curry comparisons and stylistically, that's just not even close to the case, where Trae has the ball a ton and there's this call to have Trae off the ball way more. And he would be so threatening setting screens and everything. It's just like, okay, that's wonderful, but that's just not who he is. So we need to accept who he is. And who he is when this person runs a pick and roll and gets a high screen from Clint Capella or John Collins or them both, good things happen for the Atlanta Hawks offense. He makes every read. He makes every pass. In the offseason, one of his primary objectives was to, after watching the playoffs and watching Chris Paul, he was like, I need to add a mid-range shot to my game that can threaten defenses that drop when I'm coming off a ball screen. And he's become one of the most accurate mid-range shooters, pull-up mid-range shooters in the entire NBA. So there's really no offensive weaknesses here. I understand defensively, it's very problematic. We saw in the playoffs last year, though, and I'm trying not to – I know we're just judging this season. We saw in the playoffs last year that he can play defense against – in certain matchups on a big stage, and he can compete. He hasn't done it this year as much as one would like. But at the same time, it's like his offense is everything. Like he's so – special offensively. He's doing things and putting up numbers that the league has never seen from someone his age and someone his size. So he's like a lock for me to be on all NBA somewhere. I think it would be a crime to leave him off given just his statistical impression. I have him third team as a third team guard.
So if I'm not mistaken, I think you said you had DeMar DeRozan as one of your 13 forwards. And so that would leave one other 13 forward that you have to give, because you put Luka at guard. I had him at forward. So if you have anything else to add on DeRozan, and who was your other 13 forward?
I don't think I have anything else to say about DeMar. He's been terrific. Yeah, so the other forward I have, I mean, this is, we're just going to say, like, the forward position is really, I mean, you put Luka as a forward, so I don't think you had this problem. But if you put Luka as a guard, and,
yeah,
like, it's just, It's tough. It's slim pickings.
This is why I have Luka at forward. Like, it's not because I think he belongs more at forward. It's because that's where, you know, I'm comfortable enough to put him there. Not because
of the same position. Totally understandable. So for me, it goes down to there's two players who I'm looking at for this last spot. Jimmy Butler and Pascal Siakam.
Ooh,
Those are the two forwards that I have. I think Pascal has had quietly like a really good season and is still just like this guy who, like, the last few years, I think, have really damaged his reputation in several ways. And, you know, Toronto as a whole was obviously very disappointing last year. In the bubble, Pascal Siakam was maybe the most disappointing individual player or someone who played worse than they should, who has been an all-star and been an all-NBA player. He just didn't look like that. And I think there's that the taste of that is still in the minds of some, but he's incredible. Like, he flies around on defense. He guards multiple positions. He's averaging 22, 8 and 5, hitting the three ball, shooting 50% from the floor, pretty high usage. So, like, even though he didn't make an all-star team, the way he's played of late has been tremendous. And I think that the narrative of Fred VanVleet actually being Toronto's best player was really nice earlier this season. And Fred VanVleet is tremendous. There's a reason why Fred VanVleet is not really even factored into the All-NBA discussion and Pascal Siakam. Yes, because he's a card that is also a factor. But I think Pascal Siakam is Toronto's – he reasserted himself as Toronto's best player, go-to crunch time option, and a guy who can get a bucket in one-on-one coverage against just about any matchup. So it's between him and then Jimmy Butler.
So before we get to Jimmy Butler, I do think Fred VanVleet has had the best season for a Raptor. I think Siakam is the Raptors' best player and also somebody ascending to the finish. As we look at the rest of these games, I wouldn't be surprised if Siakam deserves even more consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's been great. Yeah, I mean, a small part of it. Look, I think Jimmy Butler is deserving. So I'll say that at the top. He's having a very typical Jimmy Butler year where he just kind of draws a ton of fouls, lives in passing lanes, you know, gets his 26-6, doesn't shoot threes, doesn't make threes.
Well, I mean, usually he's a little better than going like months seemingly without making a three, right? Like,
fair.
This is well below his normal standard. You won't find a bigger fan of Jimmy Butler's game and what he brings to a team than me. But I obviously didn't have him on my team either. And the blow up he had with Spoelstra, I think, is something, right? Where I want to look at, what are you contributing to chemistry? You know, what are you bringing there? Again, very difficult to evaluate from afar. Mm-hmm. If you want to say that was a positive, I guess that I kind of doubt. Maybe it becomes a positive. Maybe it becomes a positive, right? Maybe it's a tipping point that fixes some things that were going wrong. But I think it was a sign that, like, oh, there's some issues here that are detrimental to winning.
Right. In this case, I'm trying to separate Jimmy Butler the person from Jimmy Butler the basketball player.
Well, see, this is why I don't try to, because I think Jimmy Butler the person wears on people, and I think that negatively can negatively affect his teams. And if it's negatively affecting this team with this group of players, like, oh, I get how it negatively affected Cat and Wiggins, especially when they were younger. Like, it wasn't the right leadership for them. Whoever you want to pin the blame on, I get that. But if, like, Eric Spoelstra and Udonis Haslam and the rest of this veteran team aren't responding to him, like, isn't that a negative for what he's bringing to your team?
Dan, sometimes you got to judge the art, not the artist. You know what I mean?
No, I don't. But I look forward to you excited.
No, that's all I have to say about that. So a part of it is also just, like, and I know this isn't right, but it just feels stupid not having a player from the team that's been in first place the most this season, the most days in the Eastern Conference on an All-NBA team.
You can't even say, like, the guy who, like, on the best team. You're like, the guy who's been on the team that was, like, wasn't first but is clearly collapsing to the finish and won't finish.
Yeah, exactly. They might finish in fourth. Yeah.
The most days in first is a heck of a stretch.
It's a fact, though. We come to this podcast for facts. That's technically a fact.
No, that's your podcast. This podcast.
Sure. So, but like, yeah, like it's just that's part of the case for me and why I would try to squeeze him on here. In some way to reward the Miami Heat for the ridiculous season they have. I mean, he's played 53 games. He's been in and out with various injuries, tailbone, ankle. You know, he plays so hard and plays through a lot of stuff, but hasn't been able to log the same amount of minutes as he has in the past. And I think that is what makes it a little tough to kind of put him on an All-NBA team. I try not to factor in, to be honest, like the blow up, which was recent. Although I will say, Eric Spoelstra was my coach of the year before that recent 4-game slide, and then that 4-game slide happens, and it's like that episode. I was just like, I love Spo. I'm not saying he was wrong for throwing a clipboard at his star player. I'm not in a position to say that's right or wrong of him to do, but it has me being like, okay, I kind of can't give coach of the year to someone who, I guess, like oversaw an incident like that and partook in an incident like that. And clearly let their emotions get the best of them. But again, I don't know exactly what happened or what was said. But so, yeah, like the case for Jimmy is just Miami's great. They're really great when he's on the floor because he does all these great things. He's a fulcrum of their offense, which actually has been, I wrote about this today. Their offense has actually been pretty good in the half court recently. For the season, it's been pretty meh, and his three-point shooting is a reason for that. But he's so good off ball, which makes him so valuable on a team that, you know, is trying to get Bam offensive opportunities, has Tyler Hero on it, the sixth man of the year. And then there's Kyle Lowry also lingering, who, you know, needs his touches, needs his shots. So I appreciate the subtle ways that Jimmy Butler helps a basketball team. Does a lot of the dirty things, a very grimy player, very smart player, very selfless player. And so that's, I guess, the case for him. And his numbers aren't bad either.
So just to clarify, you do have him over Siakam right now?
I do. Okay. Yes, right now.
If I had a forward spot, I would also give it to Jimmy Butler for all those reasons you said at the end. But again, Siakam rising to the finish. So I think we have one spot left. I think this is very, very close.
It is.
I think Karl Anthony Towns is going to get it. I think the narrative is there. I think there's a lot of voter fatigue for Rudy Gobert for the third team center. Unless somehow Jokic and B both make the first team and then they can probably both make a third team. Although I think there might be some consideration for Bam Adebayo ahead of Rudy Gobert because of voter fatigue. I don't really have Bam in this race. To me, it's a two-person race between Karl Anthony Towns and Rudy Gobert. Towns far better offensively, Gobert far better defensively. As much as I say that individually offense matters more, and I think that is the case, that's less so at center, right? Center is the position where that you are, because you're close to the basket, have so much ability to cover defensively. And I don't know. I am leaning Towns because he's just been phenomenal offensively and held up well enough defensively, kind of like a poor man's version of the Jokic candidacy, a very poor man's version of the Jokic candidacy. I think Towns, if he had just said, I'm the best shooting center of all time instead of the best shooting big man of all time, like, it would have been correct. It might still be correct as big man, but now we have to have this debate with Dirk Nowitzki, and it gets more complex. And that's, you know, I could go either way on that one. But if he just said best shooting center, like, what he provides offensively from his position is phenomenal. There's incredible touch from the perimeter. He can go inside and score. I don't think he's responsible for the Timberwolves picking it up defensively, but he's fitting into it, right? That, like, when Patrick Beverley brings the intensity, he's feeding off it in a way he didn't, in a way it looked like he was resisting with Jimmy Butler. But again, I don't know. Rudy Gobert is doing what he always does almost. I think he's not quite as impactful defensively, but had room to fall off and still be the best regular season defender. I don't know. Rudy Gobert's game is generally considered more boring, and I'm afraid I have voter fatigue in having Towns over Gobert.
So I have Cat. I'll say that off the top. I think it's very close. The more I think about Rudy Gobert, I think he's one of the better floor raisers, like floor raising stars in the league, and has been for years. Mm-hmm. And the way that Utah consistently has an elite defense when he's on the floor, including this year, his obviously his screen and dive game is terrific and helps open up so much for that offense and helps them shoot a ton of threes. And he's shooting like 70 whatever percent from the floor. So he's great in that aspect. When I look at Cat, like, he not only raises the floor of an offense in a way that it really doesn't matter who's around Karl Towns when he's on the floor. His entire career, his team has been amazing on offense. Like, if he's there and he's that big who's drawing rim protectors, forcing rim protectors to come out of the paint, able to not only able to punish switches in the post easily, but like, it doesn't matter who's guarding him. He can score in the post, or he'll draw a foul in the post. Like, he's just such an efficient offensive player, so skilled, very good passer, really hard to guard, comes off screens, really one of a kind, and I think still underrated, honestly, on that end. But so I think he also raises the floor in his own way, but his ability to like impact the ceiling of a team and raise it is, this is like the first time we're really seeing Karl Towns, who's a few years younger than Rudy Gobert, surrounded by talented players. And I know that some of them make up for his shortcomings on the defensive end, but I also think that the defensive system that Minnesota has deployed this season, where he's not dropping, it's not soft coverage. He's mm-hmm. up at the point of attack. He's blitzing. He's moving his feet. He's scrambling around. And that's worked really well for Minnesota by and large for most of this season. So I do not think that he is a liability on the defensive end at all, as could be said at earlier points in his career. And I just think, like, I get the you know, the polar opposite way that it's so easy to compare these two, where one's great at defense and one is great at offense, and who's better at the other side of the ball, and that's the person. I just think Karl Towns has had a better season than Rudy Gobert. It's like very elementary to me, maybe a little too elementary, but he's just like the 60 ball. The anyone who clowns Russell Westbrook like that just deserves an automatic bid on to an All-NBA team. He's just had a fantastic season. And the players
we've got to carve out two additional spots for Patrick Beverley and Reggie Jackson.
Absolutely. Yeah, like, it's.
I was gonna say, I'm with you. I'm glad you put it well, better than I did, I guess, of why I'm leaning Towns. I feel a little better about it. Like, I don't know. I think you are slighting Jimmy Butler a little bit when you say it's his first time with good teammates. Jimmy Butler onto himself, like, was a good teammate. I know there wasn't quite the depth there that the Timberwolves might have now of good teammates, but. He's fitting into it far better than he did before, no question, right? There's right. Something too, being a good he was in a lot of ways the good stats bad team player. He's not that anymore. He's good stats good team player. Yeah, I'm leaning Towns, but I think he's going to get it comfortably because I think people look at scoring and the narrative is that they're better behind him, but I do think it's very close.
He also impacts winning.
So does Gobert.
Oh, absolutely. So does Gobert. But like, I do think when you watch, you know, especially some of these recent games that Utah has lost, where it's like, okay, we're just going to go small now and we're going to switch this pick and roll and we're going to put a guy who's 6'4 on Rudy Gobert and we're going to dare you to throw the ball to Rudy Gobert and we'll see what he can do. And so like that is so detrimental to the Utah Jazz. Like that's one of their fundamental flaws as a team that should be a title contender but probably isn't. And I just wish that at this point in his career, he had like one post move or like could dribble twice and do something. Like, honestly, I just think the gap between, I understand the screen and diving and I understand what that does to an offense. And I get that he's a lob threat. I get the offensive
rebounding. Yeah.
100%. I get all that. But I just think that the gap between the two and what you can do on offense and how you, I guess Rudy does help his teammates for sure on offense. But like, I just think Karl Towns is like just miles and miles and miles better.
Towns is the centerpiece of the offense. Like Rudy Gobert can do some complimentary, very nice things offensively. But Towns is, you know, what everything revolves around.
100%. And I think a lot of people sometimes like, it gets to the point where I value scoring a lot.
Yeah.
I think like the point of the game on offense on every possession, the point is to put the ball in the basket and the point is to stop the other team from putting the ball in the basket. So if you can put the ball in the basket efficiently with a very high usage, you're an excellent player. And when your team is winning and you're also doing that, and your assist total is pretty high and your town's a size and you create all these ridiculous issues, like physically just absolutely overpowering the Boston Celtics the other day.
Oh, there it is. That's what's going on here. If you can do this to the Celtics, you must be really good.
Exactly.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. That's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.